From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we have a fascinating discussion with Thomas Mullaney, professor of Chinese history at Stanford, about the development and challenges of putting the Chinese language, with its thousands of characters and no alphabet, into a traditional QWERTY keyboard for typing. Fascinating story that most of us would have never thought of. Then we talk with Dr. Keith Koper from the U of U seismograph stations about their earthquake monitoring program and their research, education, and outreach. This is especially timely with the Great Utah Shakeout, a statewide earthquake drill on April 18th. Stay with us. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Traditional computers, at least as we understand them in the Western world, and the programming of them were built around the standard QWERTY keyboard with letters. But how do you build a computer system when your language has tens of thousands of characters and no alphabet? This is the question that our guest, Thomas Mullaney, professor of Chinese history at Stanford, takes on in his new book, The Chinese Computer, A Global History of the Information Age. Based on 15 years of research, this illuminating story presents the history and evolution of Chinese language computing technology and the impact it had on the Chinese language itself. Tom, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we talk about computing and typewriters and keyboards, tell us about the written Chinese language and what makes it so different from like Latin, our own, or Cyrillic.
Sure. The first basic premise is that unlike the Latin alphabet or the Cyrillic alphabet, there is no alphabet in Chinese writing. There is no syllabary either, as you can see, as there is in Japanese hiragana. So many writing systems are built out of these elements, whether letters or syllables, and you string these together and you more or less approximate the sound of the language. Chinese writing, Chinese script evolved in a different way. At the outset, it was like many writing systems, it emerged, think of Egyptian hieroglyphics, it emerges with a relatively small number of symbols. These symbols represent a concept. And what happened to many other writing systems is that a shift was made where these symbols no longer represented particular concept, but rather began to represent specific sounds. And then those symbols would then be used to approximate in writing and written form the sound of the language. Now, Chinese writing does have a phonetic element. You can look at a Chinese character and make some inferences about the sound of the character, but it is not an alphabetic script. It emerged and grew along a different pathway. And for the better part of human history, that was just fine. It didn't matter. 15th, 16th century visitors to the place we now call China were absolutely blown away. You could buy books for the cost of a bowl of noodle soup at a time when in Europe, books were still quite expensive. Even before the Gutenberg Revolution, people were visiting China in amaze. This only becomes a problem, the problem of Chinese writing, when you get to the 19th century and you have all of these new technologies from electric telegraphy onward that really depend upon the existence of an alphabet to work, like Morse code or a typewriter. And Chinese doesn't have an alphabet, so how is the Chinese writing system going to function within this new modern family of telecommunication systems?
Prior to this book, you wrote a book called The Chinese Typewriter, and it really goes into the foundations of creating a typewriter. And I know that we just grew up learning the QWERTY keyboard. We just have always taken for granted letters. But the Chinese alphabet, like you said, they don't have letters. How was that? This is a big question. How was that translated onto a keyboard of, let's say, 30 or 40 keys?
Right. It's sort of like, how do you pass an elephant through a keyhole? This was what in engineering world and later computer science world, a wicked hard problem. This was something that was, I have archival materials of mid 20th century Stanford engineering classes where this was the puzzle, how to build a typewriter for the Chinese writing system. And so broadly speaking, there were two concepts or two approaches to the question. One of them was, let's steal a page from the playbook of the Western world and the alphabetic writing systems, and let's kind of imagine that Chinese does have something like an alphabet. And all they meant by that was, if you were to look at 1,000 Chinese characters, even a non-speaker of Chinese would notice that there are certain shapes that show up again and again and again, these kind of modules out of which characters are built. And that's true. So there's a set of repeating shapes that show up again and again and again. So what if we took not full Chinese characters, but rather these repeating shapes, and we put those onto basically metal, and we, instead of spelling the sound of Chinese characters the way you would spell C-A-T as cat and D-O-G as dog, we would shape spell Chinese characters module by module on the page. So one whole family or approach of Chinese typewriters adopted that approach. And ultimately the one that wins out, however, was a very different approach, which was, let's take a statistical frequency kind of analysis, is that Chinese, just like every other language on earth, some words appear a lot more often than others. I, and, we, you, me show up a lot more than aardvark and anachronistic. There's a real long tail of word usage. And so if we could do a statistical analysis of which characters in the Chinese lexicon are absolute must-haves and which ones are sort of optional and rarely used, we could build a typewriter that, although it doesn't fit all, say, 100,000 characters, it has the 2,500 characters that we need the most, and that will account for upwards of 90% of all usage. And that the so-called common usage Chinese typewriter is the one that in the 20s becomes the only approach to mass manufactured Chinese typewriters.
Wow. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Professor Thomas Mullaney. He's a professor of Chinese history at Stanford, and he is the author of a new book called The Chinese Computer. It's a follow-up to The Chinese Typewriter. Okay, so Tom, let's say, I assume you are a native speaker of English.
Mm-hmm, yes.
But I have heard you speaking also, I guess it's Mandarin, and you sound to me extremely fluent. You know, we in the English language, we have also these words, the number of, you know, really commonly used words. And if we have a smaller vocabulary, that set is smaller. If we have a larger vocabulary, it's bigger, and so on. But if you are a person who is this input method editor, if you are a person that puts these characters onto this typewriter or computer keyboard, does that mean you know 100,000 characters?
I like that question. Yeah, so the way that, just a foundationally, you know, the way that if you're sitting in Shanghai or Chongqing, or for that matter, you are simply a Chinese-speaking person as a first or second language anywhere in the world, and you crack open your MacBook Pro, your Windows machine, whatever your store-bought machine is, that computer will off the shelf nowadays come preloaded with these things called, as you noted, input method editors. These programs that you can use to turn a standard QWERTY keyboard into a device that allows you to type Latin letters and Arabic numerals, but get Chinese out in the process. And that's a really interesting relationship, because what that means is, as I look down on my keyboard, there is no Chinese there. I see the letters of the Latin alphabet, I see symbols, but I can use these symbols in order, as you noted, to produce any one of, say, 100, you know, for a nice round number, 100,000 Chinese characters. The really interesting thing is, there is not just one way to do that. In fact, there are a theoretically infinite number of ways that we could define the relationship between the letters on the QWERTY keyboard and those 100,000 Chinese characters. There's lots of different ways we could map that. Just two broad ways you could think of it is, nowadays, the average Chinese computer user will use an input method editor that is phonetic. They're using the letters of the Latin alphabet to spell the sound of the Chinese character they want according to standard Chinese. So these phonetic systems. Phonetic input is really recent in the history. For the better part of the history of Chinese computing, people weren't using the letters Q, W, E, R, T, Y to spell the sounds of Chinese, they were using these symbols on our QWERTY keyboard to describe the shape of Chinese characters, where a Q could represent a particular stroke or a shape of a character, an angle, a structural feature of it. And so, as you can imagine, depending on the inventor of that input method editor, there is no one way to map the letters of the Latin alphabet onto the shapes of Chinese characters. And in fact, I have documented over 1,000 different input method editors that have been used to do this. So back to the question is, when you're using a QWERTY keyboard to input Chinese, you still are relying upon your own vocabulary, so to speak, of Chinese. Like, it's, you still know what you know, and you're trying to produce it on the screen. But as you push the keys, the input method editor will be making suggestions to you on a little pop-up menu that follows you around the screen. Do you want this Chinese character or that Chinese character? Do you want this Chinese character? And you will inevitably end up seeing Chinese characters that either you didn't already know, or that are less familiar to you, or some of them are extremely obscure because they match the criteria of what you're typing in. It's not what you want. It's not what you're going to select, but you are kind of encountering it. So it's a different model of using a computer. In English, what you type is what you get. If I want to write the dog bit the cat, it's T-H-E space D-O-G bit. It's a very linear process. Chinese input is not spelling. What you're doing is you're giving instructions to the computer, and you're telling the computer, basically, these are the features of the Chinese character that I want. Please go into memory, find it, bring it back to me so that I can confirm that that's the one that I actually wanted. It's a circular process. And so you do end up having a different relationship with the language, a different relationship with the computer itself than you do, say, in English or French or Cyrillic, many other writing systems that don't function in this way computationally.
So when you're sitting in front of a computer, Tom, and you're about to type out an email to someone you know, a colleague in China, mm-hmm. do you just skirt around this whole thing by doing voice to text or dictation?
No. What's interesting is that voice to text, you know, obviously it's incredible technology. I use it all the time when I'm sort of walking and taking notes or hands-free driving. But what's fascinating is that if you think about it, the maximum speed of voice to text is the speed of voice. I mean, this kind of goes without saying. But input, Chinese input, really is part of a genealogy of human-machine, human-computer interaction that dates back to things like a courtroom stenotypist with a stenotypewriter, which is different than a QWERTY keyboard. That person can record at faster than the speed of human speech. The technology itself enables one to record faster than the human typically speaks. Voice to text is maxed out at that. So ironically, voice to text is a more convenient technology, but in terms of speed and efficiency, it actually is an interesting step backward in terms of speed. We have at our disposal faster recording technologies, and Chinese input and input method editors are part of the family tree of that approach of interacting with writing technology.
So Tom, earlier you mentioned that it was so accessible for people in China to buy a book cheaper than a bowl of noodles. How did they mass produce these books? Because Lynn and I were talking ahead of time, trying to envision some sort of press. I mean, with the Gutenberg press, it was standard letters that you just arranged in whatever sentences you wanted. But how did they do it in China?
Well, the simple two-part answer is, one, movable type printing was invented in China centuries before the Gutenberg invention. And to put it simply, they took one look at it and said, no, we already have a technology that works far better for our purposes. And that technology is xylography, or woodblock printing. So in woodblock printing, you take a plank of wood and you have a calligrapher or an artist produce an ink master. And then you hand that ink master, the inked board, over to a carver. Very interestingly, the carver themselves does not need to be literate in Chinese. Often you have non-literate. Their ability is that they're incredible carvers, and they don't need to know what the words say. And so you have this incredibly low-cost technology that gives incredibly faithful production. It allows for all different styles of Chinese calligraphy. It allows for the merger of text and image, or text and diagrams. and then you ink the surface of that wood master, and you can produce books at incredibly low cost in an era when, you know, again, in Europe prior to the Gutenberg Revolution, books were all produced by hand. We think of calligraphy now as an art form. Calligraphy used to be the way you made books in scriptoria, and the larger the books, the more illustrious. These were extremely expensive objects to own. So you can imagine how shocking it was to, you know, for some Jesuit missionary to arrive in Edo, Japan, or the place we now call China, and to see books all around. Some have referred to it as the woodblock revolution that is understudied because of the relative fascination with Gutenberg. So this is to say that we now think of, from the 19th century onward, of the Chinese writing system as having some kind of challenge or obstacle that is born of the fact that it's not alphabetic and there's so many characters. But that is a really recent story. The first technology where the Chinese writing system and the needs and demands of the technology really butted heads for the first time is Morse code. Because Morse code, just like the typewriter keyboard, just like the computer keyboard, has a very limited amount of real estate. The quantity of the real estate has been perfectly tuned to the dictates of the Latin alphabet. You know, did it, all those dots and dashes were tuned by Samuel Morse and Alfred Vail for how English behaved. Well, if you have only a few dots and dash spaces, and then you have a non-alphabetic script that has tens of thousands, I think it doesn't work. And so the first puzzle of Chinese on the one hand and so-called modern information technology on the other, where these two really butt heads, was telegraphy. And then the story kind of repeated itself. Then came the typewriter. Then came the linotype machine. Then came electric word processing. Then came personal computing. And in each of these, the origin point of these technologies, by and large, was the English-speaking world. And so, to no fault of their own, engineers operating in these parts of the world, they started with what they knew, which was English. Remington typewriter started with English. Mergenthaler linotype started with linotype. The problem happened when these technologies began to globalize and be spread around the world. And then once again, over and over and over again, they butted up against the now problem of Chinese. And some in China and some outside of China, their imaginations led them to a very limited conclusion, which is the only answer is for Chinese to abandon its writing system altogether, fundamentally sever this part of its very long culture and civilization. That's the only way to participate in the family of modern nations. But there was a subset of engineers and linguists and entrepreneurs and kind of hobbyists from around the world, not just ethnically Chinese, who said, I don't buy that. I don't think that's the answer. And they sort of just tried to shove their mind through that keyhole for decades and decades and decades. And most of what they did failed.
Well, in the book, you talk about how the U.S. military was also very interested in creating this typewriter. I get it if you're a linguist or an engineer or a writer. Why was the military so interested in this?
Propaganda. If you own the means of printing and reproducing Chinese language texts at a rate never before seen in human history, then you could flood the world in Chinese language materials that are suited to your propaganda mission. And this is the beginning of the Cold War, at a time especially when the Soviet Union and China were still part of a Sino-Soviet bloc prior to the Sino-Soviet split when they part ways in the 60s. And so the question of who is going to get first to the question of mass scale electro-automation and eventually computerization of Chinese had huge implications. And for that matter, it's not just the American military that was after this, the solution. The Taiwanese military, the PRC military, the Soviet military, not to mention practically every major company involved in print technology you could imagine, IBM, and then later Apple, Microsoft, and so forth. This was one of the puzzles to crack.
And so the outcome of that has been what?
The outcome is that after an incredibly long string of failures, I joke with my colleagues that basically the summary, if you take the Chinese typewriter and the Chinese computer and you just merge them together, that it goes a little bit like this. Failure, 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 vast success. the tech envy of the global world that people are dying to get into. So what ends up happening is that out of a century and a half of scrutinizing this question, being willing to radically rethink all of the ingredients, language, technology, that eventually people discover a potential solution to this problem, which is input. So it's a very subtle thing, but the answer, it turns out, or maybe just let's say one of the answers or the only answer that has presented itself thus far, the answer, it turns out, is that we don't have to get rid of the QWERTY keyboard. We don't have to imagine an entirely alternate technological world. All we have to be comfortable with is the notion that Q doesn't have to equal Q. W doesn't have to equal W. What you type is not what you get necessarily. And once, it seems like a very, very small step to make, but the implications of that are immense. Because once you settle upon the idea that pushing a key does not result in that symbol appearing on this on the page or the screen, it opens up this vast space of exploration. One metaphor that you could think of is, how do you play the guitar with a piano? Well, one would say it can't be done. And it turns out, of course, it can be done, as electronic music and music instrument digital interfaces have shown us, that if you think of, if a piano becomes not just an instrument that can only play itself, but rather a piano-shaped interface, a piano-shaped controller, that sure, I could play the piano with it as it's plugged into a computer that's actually making the audio files run, but I could also play the oboe, the woodwinds, the drum, the trombone. But it requires a technological set of fixes, but most of all, it requires a conceptual leap that it's possible to play the oboe or the drums with the piano. It's possible to play the drums with the oboe. In China, the more than a billion computer, Sinophone computer users use the piano of the QWERTY keyboard to play the guitar of Chinese. And that was the beginning of the solution that made large-scale Chinese computerization possible.
Wow, it's such a crazy story. That's actually a good metaphor. And I wanted to ask you, and it may just be another rabbit hole that we don't really have time to get into, but you talk a little bit about sort of the elite classes, those who have smartphones, who are communicating, you know, whether it's our kids walking around texting each other or me playing Wordle or Connections on my iPhone. That's actually putting people at a disadvantage in those kind of upper socioeconomic levels in China. What can you just briefly explain why?
I mean, the opening, so I open with this kind of moral panic that is that China experiences in like the 2010s that is called character amnesia, where people are starting to notice that even very high-ranking people with two PhDs, the top of their career, that they seem literate when their electronic devices are on, but once they power down and you hand them a piece of paper and a pen, they seem no longer to remember Chinese characters. A lot of people have sort of asked about that. And I try to turn that on its head. I sort of start with that. I play with it as if I believe it, but I fundamentally don't. In the same way, the argument that, you know, I come back to over the course of the book is that just because a person powers down their devices and you hand them a pen and pencil, and then suddenly they seem to have deficiency with their language, that's the wrong question to be asking. Are they non-literate? Is something happening to them? Are they forgetting how to write? And the answer is no, they're not forgetting how to write. Writing itself, as it has always been, is a technological act. And as the technologies of writing change, then kind of the criteria of how we define being able to write changes as well. Imagine if after the Gutenberg Revolution, someone went back in time and just stopped everyday people on the street and handed them a flat-edged pen the way that would have been used in a scriptoria and said, produce Gothic black letter, and the person couldn't do it. Are we forgetting how to write? It's like, no, we're not forgetting how to write. It's that the instruments of writing, the material of writing, is constantly changing over time. I don't know how to chisel in stone No Chinese person I have ever met knows how to make a Zhou Dynasty bronze all that well, but they're still literate. It's just right. that now we have an extra tool at our disposal, or a class of tools at our disposal, which are digital in nature, but they're still tools. They're still tools. So the idea of powering down their laptop and then testing their literacy, it's a strange test to place on it. And so what I end the book by saying is that writing itself, not just in China, but writing globally, is transforming before our eyes. But the metrics we have to like try to make sense of that change haven't caught up with it. We're still using earlier ideas of writing to try to understand our current situation, but our current situation is not the same anymore, or it has drifted in a different direction.
Well, our guest today has been Professor Thomas Mullaney, professor of Chinese history at Stanford. We're talking about his new book, The Chinese Computer, A Global History of the Information Age. And Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And if you have a chance, go online and take a look and just Google Chinese computer. It's fascinating to see all those characters carefully placed onto a QWERTY keyboard. Well, stay with us. We'll be right back with Dr. Keith Koper from the U of U Seismograph Stations. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
It's easy to forget on the Wasatch back that we do live very near an active fault, but earthquakes are continually happening around us, maybe not close enough to always feel, but they are happening. Monitoring these continual motions and shifts are the U of U seismograph stations. These stations, situated throughout Utah and surrounding states, pick up and report on regional earthquakes. With this data, scientists at the U of U are able to develop a better understanding of earthquakes in our area. This can then help reduce the risk from earthquakes in Utah thanks to their research, education, and public service. Here to tell us more about the seismograph stations and the important work they are doing is Dr. Keith Koper. Keith, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so remind our listeners of the fault systems that we live on here in Utah.
Sort of in northern Utah, the biggest fault system is called the Wasatch Fault System. And one way to think about it is like a tree. And so there's a big trunk, and then there's all these limbs that are basically offshoots. And so it's almost like a connected web of different faults. And so that's why we usually call it a fault zone. And so instead of just one particular fault, there's this whole system that's sort of connected. And we divide it up into about 10 of these different segments. And each segment might be anywhere from sort of 30 kilometers, maybe to 60 kilometers long. And we think when we get a big earthquake, it's usually one of these segments that actually ruptures in the earthquake. And one of the big uncertainties that we have is whether the earthquakes can actually jump across these different segments along the fault zone. And we just don't know, but it's been observed in other fault zones. And, you know, if that happens, then you get a much larger earthquake. If you go down to the southwestern part of the state, there is the Hurricane Fault System. And, you know, it's one of the parts of the state that's really growing population-wise, infrastructure, and so on. And we have less of a geologic record there, but there's still pretty good evidence that we could get pretty big earthquakes, you know, over magnitude 6. You know, maybe near Cedar City, St. George, places like that. And so I don't want your listeners to get the impression it's only sort of in northern Utah. It's actually throughout the state. And so really the only place that has sort of low hazard from, or let's say reduced hazard from earthquakes is down in the Four Corners region and in the southeast. But otherwise, there's a history of earthquakes throughout the state.
Well, a lot of us felt the earthquake back in 2020. But that fault ruptured, you know, off Great Salt Lake area. But do we have any active fault zones here in the Summit County area and the Wasatch Back that we need to worry about or even be aware of?
Yeah, there's definitely seismic hazard in, let's say, to the east of the fault trace. And the way it works is actually the main fault zone, it dips to the west. And so we see the trace like along, you know, around Salt Lake City, for instance. And when it goes underground, it kind of trends a little bit to the west and goes underneath the basins. But as you say, there is hazard, sort of related structures, and the possibility of earthquakes to the east. It's maybe, you know, we wouldn't expect as big an earthquake maybe, off the main fault zone, but there's certainly, we record little tiny ones there all the time. And especially as you get up into the northeast of the state and southeastern Idaho is quite active. Near the Soda Springs area, there was actually a decent-sized earthquake, I think about 5 years ago, and there's lots of little earthquakes there all the time. So, you know, at the university, one of the things we do is outreach and try to encourage folks to be prepared. And so even if you don't live right next to the Wasatch Fault, it still is a good idea to have a plan for what to do and maybe do some simple preparations to be ready in case a damaging earthquake does strike.
And so, Keith, that's why every year we have the Great Utah Shakeout. And if you work for, you know, the state or any municipality, I suppose the school district, everyone participates. And I think I just read it's up to like 670,000 people are participating. That's a lot of people. It's interesting because when I've participated before, it makes me feel like the big quake is imminent. And I see in a lot of ways, like maybe having a, you know, a shakeout or whatever you would call it for fire danger to be much more prevalent or prescient, but no. So a lot of people say that the big one is long overdue here in Utah. And that's just judging from hundreds of years and what the activity has been. So what do you think the big one will be? And is that true that we're overdue here?
You know, it's tricky to say we're overdue. So what we do is we make earthquake forecasts, you know, so we're not set up really to do predictions. So, you know, you can imagine like the weather forecast, you have so much, oh, this 20% of rain 2 days from now here and there. So we make these forecasts and the forecasts are based, as you said, actually on geologic evidence of previous big earthquakes. We have geology colleagues that go in and they dig trenches across the fault zones and they look at shifts in the rocks and then they can date when it happened. And so what you can do is using that geologic evidence, and the fancy word for it is paleoseismology, we can figure out that over the last, let's say, maybe 6,000 years, we've had maybe 25, what we would consider these really big earthquakes. So it's big enough that the rupture, even if it starts way underground, the actual rupture makes it up all the way to the surface and causes what we call a fault scarp, which is an offset. And then that gets sort of encoded into the geologic record and can be observed in the future by geologists. So, so anyway, we have this basic idea of how often, you know, we think maybe between every 300 years to 400 years, somewhere along the Wasatch Front, there's, you know, on average, one of these big magnitude 7 earthquakes. And, you know, in a sense, along the Salt Lake City segment, which is the one where we have the biggest risk, we have the most infrastructure, the buildings, economic resources concentrated and so forth. We think it's, you know, longer on an individual segment. And so you might get maybe something like, oh, every 1,000 years or 1,200 years or something. But as far as we can tell, yes, we're sort of due for an earthquake. And I just don't want to hype it too much and say, oh, yeah, we're overdue. People, you know, we're certainly not trying to frighten anybody. And, you know, soon to geologists could be 50 years or 100 years. And so in context, for sure, we have this non-trivial risk and hazard from a future big earthquake. And so being prepared certainly makes sense. People ask me about earthquake insurance sometimes for their house. And I usually tell people, yes, you know, for instance, I have earthquake insurance personally. And so ideally you never have to use it, you know, sort of like you don't want to make a claim, you know, but it's good to have it. And just in case something really devastating does happen.
I always think it's interesting when we hear about seismic improvements to buildings and things like that. And certainly part of the $5.2 billion or whatever it was spent to redo the airport, the seismic upgrades were part of that. And interestingly, I was just listening to something about the very recent earthquake in Taiwan. Yeah. you know, 7.4, which I'm sure you've been reading about nonstop since it happened, but they were much more prepared this time. And they kind of compared it to the damage that happened last time there was this magnitude of an earthquake. Do you feel like in what you know and in what you've studied that we are prepared along the Wasatch Front, you know, in terms of building codes and things like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I used to be the chairman of the state, you know, the Utah Seismic Safety Commission, which is a legislative, you know, directed or legislative established body. And we would talk about these kind of policy issues like what you just brought up all the time. And the short answer to your question is we're not as prepared probably as we should be. Or if you were to compare, let's say, the state of Utah with other states, for instance, California, or even Washington and Oregon, most likely, we're a little bit behind. And so we do have a big, what they call a building stock of older structures. And a lot of them have at least partially, they're constructed out of what's called unreinforced masonry. And you can just think of bricks, you know, without rebar, things like that. And those buildings are just known to fare really poorly during the shaking from a strong earthquake. And, you know, really that's where most of injuries and deaths and so on comes from are buildings during strong shaking. And so on this Seismic Safety Commission, you know, we've worked for years and years to try to get better codes, let's say, and to, especially in schools. That's always been one of our focus was, you know, you have some of these older school buildings, but unfortunately, I hate to say this, but the legislature just decommissioned our commission just this past legislative session. And so actually this body that was all volunteers, you know, we weren't paid anything, and it was engineers, scientists, people from insurance, public utilities, there's 15 of us. And we used to give these legislative recommendations. And unfortunately, right now, we're scheduled to sunset as of January 1, 2025. And so, believe it or not, you know, I hate to say this, is we're kind of taking a step backwards in our public preparation, our public engagement on this important issue. And being a past chair was a little bit frustrating for me personally, maybe. And it was sort of unclear, you know, what the motivation behind the sunsetting of this commission was, but, you know, it was, it didn't cost the state anything. And there was actually, you know, we had no sort of authority to, you know, it was just all recommendations. So it was a little bit disappointing, but, you know, we're not obviously not giving up. We're still going to be active in things like the shakeout and spreading the word about preparation, because just to go back to your question, we are a little bit behind. New buildings in general are in really good shape. But buildings that are built before the early 1970s, that's when the first big change or wave of building code improvements came. Those older buildings have this potential for these unreinforced masonry structures, and they could, in fact, fail during strong ground shaking when we get one of these bigger, big size earthquakes.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Dr. Keith Koper. He is the director of the University of Utah Seismograph Stations. And I'm going to emphasize stations because I always just assumed it was one located up at the U somewhere. But you have them all over the Intermountain West, a lot in Utah, a lot surrounding, you know, the different states. But I was really interested to read about the different types of stations. You've got the short period, long period, composite, and broadband. There were a number of the long period ones along the Wasatch Fault. What is the difference in all of those?
Okay, yeah, that's a detailed question. So you're right. So first of all, when we say seismograph station, it's like a tape recorder, essentially records sounds, and it's just sounds that are coming through the earth instead of the sounds that are coming through the atmosphere. So it's the same kind of physics, actually, as sound waves. And so, you know, the earth vibrates, and we have all these recorders out there that are recording these ground vibrations. And even if there's not an earthquake, believe it or not, there's still vibrations in the ground and can be caused by traffic, by wind. The Great Salt Lake, when you have wave action on the lake, it actually causes these little vibrations that are observed. Our stations are so sensitive, they can record a billionth of a meter, so a nanometer of motion. And all that data gets digitized, and then it gets transmitted sometimes through satellites, sometimes through radio shots, sometimes through the internet And then it all comes to our data center, which is on campus at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. And so the different seismograph stations that you mentioned, sort of short period, strong ground motion, they record sort of different frequencies or different pitches. And so you can imagine if your listeners are familiar with music, there's different scales, A, B, C, D, E, and different pitches. Some of these instruments are better at recording the high frequencies. And so I don't know a lot about music, but, you know, like a high C, you know, the ground vibrating, that would be better recorded on one of these instruments. And the strong ground motion instruments, sometimes they're called accelerometers, and they're good. They record over a whole range of wavelengths or frequencies. We have those that are deployed in cities, like in different buildings and inside structures. And the idea is when you get a very big earthquake where the ground is really shaking, that those stations won't go off scale. And so you can just kind of imagine if something gets too big, if you have a very specialized seismometer that records a billionth of a meter, if you get tens of centimeters of motion, then that instrument just goes crazy. And so you need a second type of instrument station to record it when it goes really, when the motion's really strong. We need these different types just so we don't miss anything. So we want to hear the little tiny, very tiny, subtle motions of the ground, but then we also want to be able to record the really big motions of the ground motions that we get. And then we want to record the different pitches or frequencies, you know, the really high frequencies, the treble, and then the bass as well. And all those different frequencies tell us different things about the earthquake, actually. And it helps us, for instance, figure out where exactly the earthquake happened. They help us tell how big the earthquake was, the aftershocks that are associated with a big earthquake, and so on. And so the different kinds of instruments give us this wider range of data that we can analyze.
So with this big earthquake that just happened in Taiwan, what did your sensors pick up?
For sure, we recorded it beautifully. So even though they happened, you know, across the other side of the Pacific Ocean, an earthquake that's big, that, you know, 7.4, is going to be recorded all over the world. And believe it or not, the Earth is still ringing right now from that earthquake. And so it's like if you imagine the Liberty Bell or a big bell, and you go up and hit it, you know, very sharply, and then that bell just continues to vibrate. So the whole Earth right now is sort of breathing, expanding out, expanding in because of that big earthquake in Taiwan. If you have the certain kind of seismometer, the very long period, you could record that probably for weeks for an earthquake this size. And for a very giant earthquake that's magnitude 8 or bigger, sometimes you could record it maybe over a month. Or up to months. So it's really remarkable. For us, basically, if it's a magnitude 6 or bigger anywhere in the world, we record it here in Utah. Our data is used by different agencies to help study those earthquakes. And so just as an example, the U.S. Geological Survey, the federal agency that is in charge of earthquake response, and they do global monitoring, they use our data all the time to basically locate and characterize, for instance, that 7.4 earthquake in Taiwan. And it's really kind of cool. In seismology, all our data is freely available on the internet. And so we do sometimes get these citizen scientists who will download data and do their own analysis and send us email. And so the data is, especially for students, and for researchers, maybe they're not at a university or a major university, anybody with an internet connection, really anybody with a phone, really a smartphone these days, can do basic seismology and, you know, study, get the data and study these, some of these earthquakes. There's even, just as an aside, one of the kind of exciting new technologies we have in seismology is this system called Earthquake Early Warning. Is it actually active along the west coast of the US? And again, it doesn't predict earthquakes, but once an earthquake happens or starts, if you have enough seismometers, you can send out text messages to everybody's phone. Those messages can get to the phone before the shaking or the ground waves from the earthquake get there. So that means you can actually get a warning before the shaking starts. So it's sort of like, you know, lightning and thunder. Like if you see a lightning flash, then you could say, oh no, you know, the thunder's coming, and you could have so many seconds to sort of get ready for a big burst of thunder. And so the earthquake early warning is the same way. We can kind of see the flash with our seismometers, and then we can get the message out ahead of time to say, hey, you know, even if it's 5 or 10 seconds of warning, you know, if it goes to a school or something like that, you know, the kids, you know, kids react really quick. They'll get underneath their desk. They can hold on. And, you know, if you have light fixtures coming down, that, you know, things like that, that's how a lot of injuries in the U.S. are from earthquakes. So anyway, earthquake early warning is one of our sort of exciting things. And the state did actually give us funding to do a feasibility study 2 years ago, the legislature did. And so we've done our initial feasibility study for earthquake early warning. And right now we're sort of negotiating and working with the federal government to sort of extend that and get a prototype system for earthquake early warning set up. But whenever we talk about it, you know, people are super excited about it. And, you know, they kind of get it that even if it's 10 seconds or 20 seconds, there's still things you can do. And people kind of want to know, you know, that, oh, if we have that capability with the technology to do it, people are in general want that.
Wow, that's really interesting. So considering that you can feel the reverberation or the vibration of the earth after a big earthquake like the one in Taiwan recently, it makes me wonder how faults and fault zones, if they readjust afterwards or change or shift. I mean, because seismic activity is all about shifting plates, right? So how do things change in the earth and how deep does it go?
So that's another really great question. So the bigger the earthquake, the bigger the sort of change that happens to the fault zone or to Earth's crust and so on. And we actually often use the word damage. And so there's sort of a damage zone that's created by the earthquake. And believe it or not, sometimes the pressure between the two sides of the fault is so high, you can actually melt the rock during an earthquake. And so the geologists have a name for this type of rock. It's called pseudotachylite. And when they observe these pseudotachylites in the ground, that's evidence of previous melting, actually, from the friction. And so you can imagine, you know, things get hot when you have friction. You know, these fault zones for big earthquakes can be quite big. You know, they can be tens of kilometers long, and they can be maybe 10 kilometers or more deep, you know, sort of the width, like a piece of paper. Like if you think of the dimensions of a piece of paper, you know, we have 8.5 by 11 inches, you know, that kind of area for an earthquake can be 20 kilometers by 10 kilometers. And you have friction all along that surface. And if you're in an area like California where you have strong stress, tectonic stresses from plate motions, then there's this process we call a healing process. And what happens is you've damaged and sort of broken, created fault gouge, a lot of the rocks, but then they get sort of compressed back together and they start to heal over time. And so in a place like California, the healing might progress on the scale of years, where after several years, let's say, the material has recovered its strength, whereas the damage can last longer in a place like Utah because the stresses are a little bit lower. And so that healing process takes more time. The biggest effect that an earthquake has, the biggest, you know, you asked about changes, what it does is it relieves stress. And so, you know, you have this stress that's built up inside the earth and until it can't take it anymore, and then it cracks, and that's the earthquake. When it cracks, you know, either side of the crack moves. Well, what happens at the end of the crack is you don't have any more motion, so you actually increase stress at the edges of where the crack ends. And so then you get another earthquake. Those are what aftershocks are. Most earthquakes are actually aftershocks of earlier earthquakes. It's like a cascade. So you have the big earthquake, it causes this increase in stress along where the crack ended, and then you get an aftershock there. And each aftershock is its own little crack, and then, right, it has stress buildup. And so you get this cascading sequence of earthquakes all together. And that's why we talk about earthquake sequences. Just going back to the Taiwan earthquake that you mentioned, you know, an earthquake like that is going to have aftershock at least for months and probably for years. It's sort of debated right now, at least among us, our group at the University of Utah, whether we're still having aftershocks from Magna or not. So, you know, we're about 4 years out from the magnitude 5.7 that happened in March of 2020. And certainly for about 3 years, you could tell that our rate of earthquakes in the area of that main shock was still elevated. So in terms of changes, you know, when a big earthquake happens, it certainly reduces stress in one place, but then it diffuses the stress into this cascading process and you get all these aftershocks, and it can take a long time for all that to sort of settle down. As one little kind of point that might drive it home, many of your listeners might have heard about these giant earthquakes that happened in Missouri. They're called the New Madrid or New Madrid earthquakes. They happened in 1811, 1812. They're kind of mysterious because we don't think about, you know, Missouri and Southeast Missouri and Southwestern Tennessee as places that are hazardous. Today, you know, in 2024, we still have aftershocks from those earthquakes that happened in 1811 and 1812. And again, that's because the stresses from tectonics are relatively low there. So it takes a longer amount of time for everything to heal and go back to how it was before the big earthquake happened.
For our listeners, we will include the link to the Utah Seismograph Station's website because there's so much great information on there and education. Be part of the great Utah Shakeout. I think it's what, April 18th?
Correct. Yeah, 18th.
Well, Dr. Keith Koper, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. And I'm sure you've got plenty of data to get back to analyze over the earthquake that just happened.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on your program.
And for our listeners, for more information on the Great Utah Shakeout, which is happening April 18th, go to shakeout.org, and that will be under the Cool Science Radio show tab page. And be sure and check out the Seismograph Station's website. There was a 1.7 earthquake in Wallsburg yesterday.